Where is it? Permanent here.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I love like
it. Nice.
What about you?
I'm from Texas.
Oh, dang.
I don't, yeah.
Probably like ridiculous.
So,
we've never had any weather like this. I mean, like, we've had snow. Like, I guess like this, but only for like.
It's in a brick wall. Well, she's going to be coming up to school in an hour, so hopefully I can get it.
I guess I'd rather have it hot in summer, though.
Okay.
Washington with something that John Quincy Adams had written about him in 1839, and I think I may have now left it at home, unfortunately, so I may have to bring that back. You know what, I think I will do that because I really do want to be able to read it in the full to you. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I think I'll let, oh, wait a minute, is that it? Ta-da! So, just to finish our understanding of Washington, so John Quincy Adams had known Washington pretty well because, of course, his father was John Adams, and John had served as Washington's vice president. Plus, his dad, John Adams, had traveled all over the world when John Quincy Adams was a boy and had done so as the voice of America. And this is what Adams was doing, the various courts. around the world trying to get their support for the American Revolution. So he knew Washington very well. Washington, if you'll remember, passed away in 1799, a little bit earlier than people were expecting. It was seen as an early death, even though, you know, obviously he had reached kind of the right age for, especially at that time period, to die. But you can imagine what a blow that would be for America because of how much he had symbolized, not just America, but really had symbolized all of Western civilization, too. So on the 50th anniversary, really the night before the 50th anniversary, that George Washington took the oath of office to become the first president of the United States. And don't forget what we were talking about, all of his wearing brown, riding in on a horse, the way that he approached other people. All of these things were regarded as really laying the foundation for the presidency. So there weren't that many rules on how to be president. Constitution Article 2 is obviously extremely restrictive. So everything that he does is going to set the pattern, and or at least it should set the pattern. He knows this, but he passes away in 1799. So on April 29th of 1839, John Quincy Adams, being one of the few people who still remembered actually knowing George Washington, is asked to give a speech at New York, where the Capitol had been, and to stand at the same place where Washington had taken his oath of office, and to talk about this. So John Quincy Adams, who was a great orator, ends up giving a speech that, if you look it up online, if you just look at this April 29, 1839 speech, I'm not asking you to do it, it's just if you ever get interested, you'll see that it's a 72-page speech. It probably took him 4 or 5 hours to deliver, which was not uncommon at the time in the 18th century, into the 19th century. Quite often, if any of you had a chance to look at those sermons from the religious thinkers we had, I don't think we'll get to them today, but if you had a chance to read them, you can see how detailed and how long they were. It was not unexpected in the 19th century to give upwards to an 8-hour lecture at times. And you all have to remember, you know, none of them have Twitter or Facebook or whatever, Instagram, none of that, right? This is all, they have no distractions. They're not pulling out their iPhones. There's no TV. There's not even a telegraph yet. They're still in a world that moves very, very slowly. In fact, the world moves at roughly, you know, at best, maybe 20 miles an hour at times, no more than that. So news is always very, very slow, and it can take 6, 7, 8 weeks for news to reach from New York just inward into, say, Hillsdale. It can take that long. You don't normally know what's going on. So that's one reason these speeches were always so long. They were a form of entertainment. And it was also expected, you can imagine, most people are farming. If you pack up your stuff, because you're going to leave the farm, and you have to, and you're going to go maybe ride your horse somewhere, it could be a good week before you actually get to the place you need to get. Think, you know, we want to go see a concert. We get in the car, and an hour out later, we're in Detroit. We can watch a concert. Yeah, they obviously could not do that. Yeah, that would be a very complex undertaking. So you would never go somewhere and expect to see an hour speech. That would be, what a waste of time that you went that far. So it was always expected that you give these long, very long speeches, and they were entertainment. I am not going to read all 72 pages to you, I promise. I just am going to read the opening paragraph because I want you to see how Washington is being perceived, and then I think it'll give us a nice segue into Edmund Burke as well. So here's John Quincy Adams, April 29th of 1839. Would it be an unlicensed trespass of the imagination to conceive that on the night preceding the day of which you now commemorate the 50th anniversary, on the night preceding that 30th of April, 1789, when from the balcony of your city hall, the Chancellor of the State of New York administered to George Washington the solemn oath faithfully to execute the office of the President of the United States, and to the best of his ability to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, that in the visions of the night, the guardian angel of the father of our country had appeared before him in the venerated form of his mother, and to cheer and encourage him in the performance of the momentous and solemn duties that he was about to assume, had delivered to him a suit of celestial armor, a helmet consisting of the principles of piety, justice, and honor and benevolence, with which from his earliest infancy he had hitherto walked through life in the presence of all of his brethren of humanity, a spear studded with the self-evident truths of the Declaration of Independence, a sword, the same with which he had led the armies of his country through the War of Freedom to the summit of the triumphal arc of independence, a corselet of long experience in habitual intercourse in peace and war with the world of mankind, his contemporaries of the human race in all their stages of civilization, and last of all, but not least, the Constitution of the United States, a shield embossed by heavenly hands with the future history of its country written upon it. Now that, there's a lot in that, and of course, yeah, even my favorite two or three members of the House or Senate could never speak like that today, no matter how smart they are. This is clearly very 19th century in terms of its rhetoric. But I want you to notice as well that as Quincy Adams is giving the speech, he's not only demanding a lot of his audience, he also knows that his audience will not accuse him of hyperbole. That, of course, this isn't true. No one actually believes that George Washington's mother showed up as a guardian angel. But think about the imagery that's there. It's really quite stunning. Patrick.
Well, even that last line here, the Constitution is a shield with like the future history of his people, like that is clearly setting up Washington as an Aeneas figure too.
Right? This is book 8 of Aeneas, yeah. Of the Aeneid. This is exactly when Venus descends upon her son, and Vulcan, her husband, has made all of these incredible weapons. You've got the spear, you've got the shield, and of course the shield, as you said very nicely, Patrick, in the Aeneid, has the whole history of Rome written upon it, right? Its whole future is there. So there's another, Patrick nailed the kind of classical reference here. What's the biblical reference? Almost perfectly, Shelby.
The armor of God.
Yeah, this is Ephesians 6. Right here, put on the armor of God so that you can have an armor to withstand the darts of the evil one and to not be found wanting in the day, right? To shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel and to carry the sword of the Spirit. So, in a sense, what Quincy Adams is doing perfectly is he's melding Roman mythology, especially Virgilian mythology, with Scripture. And it's incredible. There's also, you would have to be really pretty into other forms of mythology to catch it. But did anyone catch the spear studded with the self-evident truths of the Declaration? What's that from? Who else carries a spear or a staff that has all the laws written upon it? This is really deep mythology here. So it's Odin. Odin takes from the tree of creation, Yggdrasil, a branch. And upon it, he's written the natural law. That's one reason he's so wise. So when he walks around, he can pull his staff out and he can make judgment based on the eternal law. So that this is really mixing three very different stories, but making them cohesive. And that's just pretty stunning to be able to do that. And to think, you know, I know that some of you, and we kind of joked about this, or I did, on Friday, or excuse me, Monday, thinking about the cherry tree story. This is a billion times better than that story. Right? They're both made up, but this one actually tells us something. Cherry tree story doesn't really tell us much. This does. So no one's expected to walk away believing it's literal truth, but Quincy Adams is clearly mythologizing him. Bryce?
At the time of the speech, the people who would have been listening to it understood all of those references?
They would have got all of the references, yes. And they would have immediately thought, they would have thought Quincy Adams was genius for bridging Paul with Virgil. It would not have been seen as kind of upsetting, like, is he trying to put the classical world on par with Christianity? They would have seen it as kind of a perfect synthesis of those things and admired him for it at the time. Yeah, that was a great question. Good, anything else on this? So here's what I want to do for the rest of the day, and I hope this makes sense why we kind of finish with Washington. There is no possibility that we could have had a successful American Revolution without two men. And, of course, a lot of others play critical roles. Don't get me wrong, but it's only two. But really the two most important men are George Washington here. And that's in large part not just because of his skills, but really because of his virtue more than anything else. The fact that you have a man with that many talents who's willing to give everything of those talents to the public and to put those above his self-interest. That's why Quincy Adams can, bless you, Shelby, that's why Quincy Adams can get away with creating this kind of both demigod and Christian hero at once in the way that he's presenting this. Notice Quincy Adams never makes him Christ. He just makes him Christian. So there's no sense, but he does kind of make him Aeneas. That's okay. You can make someone a demigod. You just can't make someone Christ. So he's able to blend those things pretty nicely. But on the other side of the Atlantic, someone that I think we Americans have tragically forgotten is the man who stood for us in every single moment of the American Revolution, and that was Edmund Burke. Burke, of course, lives at almost the exact same time as Washington does. They just really have an overlap of, well, I should say that Burke is born just a few years before Washington, and he dies just 2 years before Washington. Excuse me, guys. My gun. Sorry. Okay, I know, very tacky, but also very Hillsdale. Not the college, but okay. Okay. I mean, notice you always walk around, people are always chomping guns. Their horses or something. Okay. I love Hillsdale. All right. So, Edmund Burke, from really the moment that he's raised, has this kind of just fierce integrity about him. And he is not a warrior. Like, that is not Burke. Washington's a warrior. Washington is truly a demigod. Burke is an intellect, and he's a poet, and he's a philosopher. So you've got the faculty of rationality and of passion with Washington. With Burke, you have the faculty of imagination. So they each kind of represent the best of the other. But Burke, and I'll give you a little bit of background about him, but just quickly to understand why he is so pro-American. As a young man, Burke was given the job of editing what was called the Annual Review. And the Annual Review was a publication put out, basically funded by all the various members of the Houses of Parliament in order to keep track of the colonies that Britain had acquired. So the Annual Register, it would be, you can imagine someone making a book every year, we probably call it an almanac, but you would make a book every year that just compiled every statistic we know about the colonies. And Burke's role was America. That's what he studied. He studied North America. So for almost 15 years throughout the 1750s and 1760s, all the way up until the American Revolution, Burke's main job was compiling all the data, trade statistics, population statistics, number of churches, whatever it was in North America. That's what Burke was writing. And this is why, you know, when we talked about the Scottish Enlightenment, and I had mentioned to you that he was good friends with Adam Smith, if any of you ever had the chance, and you should, depending on when you have time, but if you ever have the chance to read Adam Smith's second great work, The Wealth of Nations, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, if you ever have a chance to read that, you'll notice that almost every footnote is to the Annual Register, because that's where the data is coming from. So if Parliament has a debate about the colonies, they have to look to the Annual Register. So Burke already knows more than anyone in Europe about us because of that. He's never traveled to America, ever. He didn't like traveling. He never came to America. But this is what he does. It's his job. And he's so good at it that several colonies, but most especially New York, hire him as their agent in Parliament. So if New York needed something introduced into Parliament, Burke was the one who introduced it for them. So he's got this interesting background. But I want to go back a little further than that and go back to his birth in 1729. So Burke, and this is when I cautioned you, we can't just say Scottish Enlightenment, because he's actually Irish. So maybe a Celtic Enlightenment is better. But Burke is born in 1729, and not atypical for relatively well-to-do now. He's not wealthy, but he is middle class when he's born in Ireland in 1729. Almost any middle class family will have done this, because nominally, or I should say normally, not nominally, but normally, the Irish are Roman Catholic. But if you're Roman Catholic, remember, it's illegal in all of England to practice any forms of Catholicism until 1832. So in Burke's lifetime, it's not legal. So what they would do, and all well-to-do families would do this, or again, well-to-do, I don't mean wealthy, but they're making it fine. the father would always be a member of the Church of England, and the mother would remain Roman Catholic. And then they would always raise their sons Protestant and their daughters Catholic. And that's exactly what the Burkes did. That's a very typical thing to do in Ireland. So that your sons can advance, and especially, you know, if you are a farmer and you need to make sure that your land passes on to the next generation, it's illegal to pass it on to a Roman Catholic because it's illegal. So you have to pass it on to a Protestant. But what this means is that Burke grows up extremely close to his sister and his mother, always having a very deep respect for Catholicism. And in fact, we know that that was where his sympathies overall were towards the Catholic Church. But that's also going to get him in trouble, because Burke's a troublemaker. This is a guy who never holds back his own views of what he believes. So in the earliest political cartoons, which all came out in the 18th century, you know, the kinds of things we take for granted now, these political cartoons that show up that mock somebody, they were new in the 18th century. They would always show Burke, whenever they did, the people who hated him, they would always show him as a Jesuit, always. So he'd always be wearing the full black robe, and the Jesuits were the boogeymen of the Catholic Church, right? If you want to freak out a Protestant, you can show him a priest. If you want to drive them insane, you show him a Jesuit. And because the Jesuits are just, you know, they're everything bad about Catholicism, at least according to the opposition. So Burke is always seen that way. Burke ends up going to college and goes to University College in Dublin and does extremely well, not surprisingly, does very, very well. His senior thesis that he writes there becomes the very first book in the modern world ever written on the aesthetics of beauty. So it's called Of the Sublime and the Beautiful. He writes this when he's about 21. It's never gone out of print. Any of you ever take a course of philosophy on beauty, you always start with On the Sublime and the Beautiful. This is Burke's genius. The guy's amazing. I mean, he's truly one of the greatest intellects ever in history. And here he writes this, but because he writes it and he does so well, and this was normal in all of the UK, all of the British Isles, you didn't become a professor by earning an MA or a PhD. You became a professor by other professors inviting you to stay instead of graduating. And so that's how Tolkien, that's how Lewis say, this is a norm that you just get invited. You have to get a one. It's how they were on your exams, your final exams. And then once you've gotten a one, if everybody likes you, they'll vote and bring you in as a professor. They do this for Burke. And remember, Burke is a very honest man. And when they invite him to become a professor, he actually laughs at them. And he says, you know, I don't mean to be rude, but have you seen yourselves? You all live in your ivory towers. You have no idea what's going on in the world. Why would I ever use whatever talents I have simply to sit in an ivory tower and think? This world is for action. And that's Burke's response. He turns them down cold. And then he goes off and he tries to make it as a professional poet and as a philosopher. And I assume you can all kind of guess what happens. There are very few people in the world, no matter how smart or gifted, who will ever make a career being a professional poet or a philosopher. Yeah, especially if you're not in academia. And he loses tons of his money, whatever inheritance he has, he blows, because he's trying really hard to make this happen. But then he gets this job with the Annual Register, and that's what's going to support him. But most importantly, you guys remember the Commonwealth Men? Everybody remember when we talked about them and the kind of club that they created? Burke has the idea of recreating the Commonwealth Men, basically 60, 70 years after they've been gone. And so he starts meeting with a group of intellectuals in the late 1750s into the 1770s. They start meeting at a common pub in London. And they meet two or three times a week. They start discussing ideas. What do we need to do if we want to make our ideas real? They do believe in the Commonwealth. These are small R Republican thinkers. They want, in the worst way, to make politics about ideas, not about scratching each other's back or about advantages. And so they start meeting, and there are a couple of people who show up from time to time and meet with them. Charles Carroll of Carrollton, one of the signers of the Declaration, is going to law school in England during this time. Burke has him over to have
brunch almost every Sunday. John Dickinson, one of the great founders, also is a part of this group. John Dickinson of Pennsylvania, the author of the Articles of Confederation. But for Burke, these guys are just friends. They're not intimates. They're friends. They're allies. But the person that he becomes closest to is a very upper crust nobleman who's exactly the same age. They're both born in 1729. And this is a guy that we only remember as, I mean, he's got a real name, but we remember him as Lord Rockingham. And Rockingham has got all the money, and he's got all the family connections. He's from one of the largest, most important aristocratic families in England. And he and Burke become best friends. In fact, it's anytime you'll ever, the famous portraits of Rockingham, he becomes prime minister twice, but during the American Revolution, well, right before and then during. Anytime you've ever seen a portrait of Lord Rockingham, they will always have an image of Burke behind him, as though they're almost one person, because all of Rockingham's ideas come from Burke. In fact, Rockingham says, look, I'm in the Lords, I'm a Lord, I'm in the House of Lords, and I want to actually do something with my position here. I don't want to just be a placeholder. I need to do something with this power that I have. And so he hires Burke to be his full-time ideas man. You are, at this point, my professional poet. You're my writer. You come up with all these ideas. And that's what Burke does. Burke becomes the leading intellectual of what were called the Rockingham Whigs. And that becomes a sub-party. And this is where Burke is going to have all kinds of influence. Because not only is he going to represent Rockingham, but in order to make Rockingham's ideas good, not just in the House of Lords, but in the House of Commons, Burke then runs for a seat in the House of Commons and gets it. So he's in Parliament in the House of Commons while Rockingham is in the Senate, basically, right, the House of Lords. I hope you guys all see why this is so important. So Burke is brought into Parliament in 1765, but, and this, I love this, and I want you guys just to kind of think about how important this is. Burke's very first speech, which was called the Virgin Speech or the Maiden Speech, his very first speech he ever gives was January of 1766. And almost everybody who was there, including William Pitt, I talked briefly about Pitt, he was the great prime minister during the French and Indian War, including William Pitt, they all said it may have been the greatest oration ever given in the House, ever, in the history of the House. And nobody expected this because Burke had never been an orator. He'd always been a writer. And so people just kind of went in and listened without taking notes. We don't have a single note from Burke's speech, even though it's regarded. In fact, Pitt says at that point, I can retire. There's now a new Pitt who can take my place. And Pitt was regarded as the greatest orator up to that point. And he just hands the crown over to Burke. But here's what we know that's really important for us. That's fine. That's a great fact, but here's what I think is critical. His very first speech that he gives is on why America should be totally left alone by the British. That is, if the British truly want to keep America as a colony, the best thing they can do is treat us as an equal. That's Burke's argument. And he, over the next 10 years, from 1766 up until about 1777, he will continually, every speech he gives, in fact, there's not a single speech he gives in Parliament that is not about Americans' rights. This is what he is talking about nonstop. Americans must be allowed their rights. If you truly want an empire, you have an empire that would be an empire of equals. That is, America must be seen as equal to Britain. There is no, if we believe in rights, natural rights in particular, there is no way that you can treat the Americans in a different fashion than you treat the English. Simply because an Englishman lives in London does not make him more or less of an Englishman who lives in Philadelphia. So this is Burke's argument. The only real empire will be an empire of equals. In other words, he's basically saying, we don't want an empire. We want a commonwealth of equals. That's what he's going for. So I want to read to you just a little bit of what he says
about the notions of America and why America is so important, especially to the British, but also so important for the English as well. This is what he says, and he gives a whole number of speeches, and we usually remember these as the speech of 1774, the speech of 1775, and so forth, and they're always about America. He says, common sense, no, in fact, let's not even say common sense, let's say self-preservation, seems to forbid that those who allow themselves unlimited right over the liberties and lives of others should never have any share in making the laws of those who have long renounced such unjust and cruel distinctions. So by the very fact you want to oppress somebody, you've already guaranteed you're not a leader. That's not what leaders do. You are trying to mold them in your image. You can't do that. He says, if we ever want to challenge America, we only have one way to do that, and that is we have the right to disagree with South Carolina and Georgia and the other slave states on the issue of slavery, but we don't have any other right to knock them. That's the only thing we have the right to challenge them on. So to Parliament, he says, again and again, I ask you to revert to your old principles. You must seek peace and ensure it. Leave America, even if she has taxable matter in her, to tax herself. I do not want to go into the very distinctions of rights, nor am I attempting to mark their boundaries. But I tell you this, leave the Americans as they anciently stood, and these distinctions born of this now unhappy contest will die along with it. They and we and their and our ancestors have always been happy under freedom. Let the memory of all actions in contradiction to that old mode of freedom on both sides be extinguished forever. Do not burden them by taxes. You didn't do it before. Why would you suddenly introduce it now? These kinds of arguments that you're making are the arguments of kings and complicated states, not for us. Leave such distinctions to the universities, not to the public realm. If you intemperately, unwisely, fatally sophisticate and poison the very source and meaning of rights and government by urging this deduction and that deduction and this oppression and that oppression, the consequences will be odious not only to those you govern, but ultimately to ourselves as well. When you teach them by these means to call sovereignty into question, when you drive him hard, do you not expect the boar caught in a corner to turn upon the hunters? If that sovereignty and their freedom cannot be reconciled, which will you take? They will cast your sovereignty in your face. I guarantee you, nobody, but especially the Americans, will ever be argued into slavery. So this is what Burr keeps saying over and over again. They are Englishmen. And therefore, they have all the rights of Englishmen going back to King Alfred and before. So every time we use Parliament to crush them, we're not only destroying them, we're also destroying a bit of our soul. We're losing a bit of who we are as Englishmen as well. And then he says this, and I love this. The mode of inquisition is going out of fashion, even in the old world. And I should confide to you that you should not introduce it into the new. The education of the Americans is on the same unalterable bottom of their religion. You cannot persuade them to burn their books of science, to banish their lawyers, or to quench the lights of their assemblies by refusing to choose those persons who are best read in their privileges. It would be no less impracticable to think of wholly annihilating the popular assemblies in which those lawyers sit. The army by which we would govern in their place would be far more chargeable to us, not quite so ineffectual, and perhaps in the end, far more difficult to control once we let it loose. And then he goes on to say, and I love this, remember, his mom is Catholic, his dad is Protestant. He says, after studying America for 15 years with the annual register, he says, these people are not just Protestants. They are the Protestants of Protestants. And if you think that they will submit to you, the king, when they won't submit to the pope, you have completely deluded yourself. These people are who they are, and you have to accept that. So Burke does this time and time again, and I love this. He goes so far in this that he actually, every time during the American Revolution, that King George calls for a fast day in which he asks for all of England to give up their food for a day so that they can pray in the honor of the soldiers fighting in America, Burke gets up in Parliament and declares it a day of national feasting in which we celebrate the Americans as the true Englishmen. He, almost any day during the Revolution, he could have been arrested and executed for what he did. Day in and day out, he supports America, and always to his detriment, because he could be killed. And there's one point, and I love this, where he gets up, and I'll just quote this briefly from his speech. He says, "I'm a good member of the Church of England, but until this war with America is over, I cannot receive communion in the Church of England, because the head of that church is not the Bishop of Canterbury, it's the King of England, it's George III. Until our churches are purified from this abominable idea, I will consider them not the temples of the Almighty, but instead the Church of Satan." So he is just called King George III, Satan. Yeah, you can't do that. And he gets away with it because he's Burke. And it's Burke who, the moment we have the battle at Yorktown and we've stopped fighting with the British, it's Burke who negotiates the peace treaty with us. Yeah, this is how important he is. He is everything for us. And once again, I think we should consider him as important to the American Revolution as anyone else. Now, there have been cooler moments in American history when we've remembered him. Some of you may know, in D.C., there's a great statue of Edmund Burke. In fact, he's the only British person in all of Washington there was a statue dedicated to him, because he is the equal of Washington. At least he was at the time, or regarded as such. Okay, so here's what I want to do. You guys had this passage from Burke, and we're going to look at it. I want to spend a little bit of time on it, but let me give you just one quick background as well about Burke. So in his lifetime, Burke fights, as I put up here on the board, he had five causes, and they're all related to one another. He spends his entire adult career in government from the 1760s until his death in 1797. He spends his entire career defending five groups of people. This is what he does. Obviously, we've already talked about the Americans. He is fully in favor not only of America being equal with Britain, but once Britain goes to war against us in the Revolution, he's on our side. He wants us to win. Okay, so that's really important. He's also, if you remember, Irish. And Ireland is still a subject colony to Britain and will remain so until about 1917. So he's fully in favor of Ireland being free from Britain's domination. He fights, almost destroys his career right after the American Revolution by fighting for the rights of Hindus in India. So he goes, and this is what we call this, you guys don't need to know all this, but it's called the Warren Hastings trial, in which there had been some judges who had been sent from Britain and had used their position as colonial governors of India to gain wealth. And Burke says, you can't do that. If you're going to colonize a people, you only go there to give them stability, not to take from them. That's not what good people do. So he's in favor of the Asian Indians. He is absolutely, and very early on, before any of the other Brits are, he is adamantly opposed to slavery and the international slave trade. And he also is in favor of giving rights to Roman Catholics and to Jews as well, because they're the outgroups. So these are all peoples that he is trying to defend in one way or another. And then this crazy thing happens. On July 14th, this is a date you guys do have to know, on July 14th of 1789, the French overthrow a prison, kill a few people, and start a revolution. Now, hardly anyone dies. There are just about eight soldiers and a few prisoners who were killed in this storming of the Bastille in France. And Burke immediately, and this is so shocking to everyone, because look at all these people he's defended, Burke immediately says, this is the worst thing that could ever happen to the world. The French Revolution. Now, Anybody want to take a guess why? What is it about the French? He hasn't even seen, you know, by 1792, we're going to have 50,000 people guillotined. But in 1789, none of that's happened. None. So why is Burke so freaked out about this? And he becomes the single, and this is generally how we remember him, he is the single leading opponent of the French Revolution. When he dies in 1797, he writes a book called, and you don't need to write all this down, but he writes a book called Letters of a Regicide Peace, in which he says, all of our peace with revolutionary France is a peace made on a lie. It's a regicide peace. It's not a real peace. We're basically letting crazy people get away with ruling themselves and ruling others. So what's he seeing here? Anybody? Yeah, Dan.
Is that they're not Englishmen, so they don't have the same traditions of
okay.
common law and natural rights as the English do.
Okay, they would. Now, this is a great way of thinking about it. They would have natural rights, right? But obviously, they don't have a common law tradition. So they do have natural rights, but what's going to change here for them? Yeah.
The fact that it's, like, completely a bloodbath and they're, like, slaughtering
it will be.
People eventually, like, that's not Christian and they're not rooted in religion.
Okay, nope, that's right. So, remember our rule, revolutions can almost always be gauged by where the church is. Burke is the first to admit the Roman Catholic Church in France is utterly corrupt. He knows that. So he's not. But obviously this revolution is going against the church as well. So Shelby.
Is it because they don't have like a, they're not doing it under a united defense of rights,
okay.
but out of like, I don't know, it's like disunited
yep.
in a way?
Okay, I'm going to put it this way. I'm just going to read to you. This is Article 3 of what is passed in November, what's called the Article, or the Declaration of the Rights of Man and of Citizen. So just listen to this language here. The principle of all sovereignty, right, all power, where does power reside? The principle of all sovereignty, all power, resides essentially in the nation. No body, no individual may exercise any authority which does not proceed directly from the nation. That's Article 3. Now imagine what that means. Think about everything we've talked about with the nature of association. Guys in Lexington could never form a militia. First Continental Congress could never form. Second Continental Congress could never form. Hillsdale College could never form. I could never marry my wife unless I get permission from the entire nation. So unlike in America and England, this is Dan's point, I think about common law, unlike our understanding of rights, where everything begins at the most immediate level and works its way up. For the French, everything is imposed from above all the way down. So Burke's argument is that the French have completely overturned the Western tradition of rights. And no matter how much they talk about rights, if rights are granted by a political body or a collective, well, at that point, it doesn't matter who or what the community or the individual are. So let me read two quotes to you from his book, on the book he writes immediately, starting with the French Revolution and publishes within just a few months. It's called Reflections on the Revolution in France that he publishes right after. All of our real attachments are to the subdivision, to the little platoon we belong to in society. It is the first principle, the germ of all of our public affection. It is the first link in a series by which we proceed towards the love of our country and of mankind. So if you grow up and you don't love your father or your mother, chances are probably pretty good you're not going to think that well of your neighbor. And if you don't think well of your neighbor, you're probably not going to like your minister or your priest or your rabbi. And if you don't like them, you're probably not going to like your school teacher. And everything starts with the family. And it all goes from there. This is where our loves go. And very few of us, yeah, how many of us are going to define ourselves immediately in this context? I mean, imagine when you all introduced yourselves on day one that you got to Hillsdale. Oh, who are you? My name is unimportant. I'm an American. I'm sure I can see someone at Hillsdale doing something like that. But you know, obviously, this is not normal, right? Think about what we do. What's your name? Where are you from? Right? And why do we do that? Well, it's not just making conversation. It is. But there's a purpose to it. You know, imagine, oh, I'm from Wisconsin. Oh, really? I went to the Dells once in Wisconsin. Or I went up to Door County. Oh, yeah, we don't live that far from. Think about everything we do. We're always making connections. That's what we do. How do you know this person? Oh, you know that person too. Well, that's amazing. Or you had this professor, you took that class. You know, how is it that we're juniors at Hillsdale and we've never met before? You know, I don't even remember seeing you in the cafeteria. How's that possible? We always do this. We don't start off by saying, this is who I am. I define myself by my loyalty to the United States of America. There's nothing wrong with patriotism. It's great. But patriotism is that thing which protects all of these subdivisions. That's what matters. Now, if America is just about some crazy idea, well, who cares? What really matters is that it protects our associations. And the French are going against that. They're basically saying, no, what matters most is you belong to the body of Frenchmen. And at that point, everything is subordinate to that. Every marriage, every church, everything. So one last paragraph here from Burke on this, and then Patrick. We begin our public affections always in our family. There is no such thing as a cold relation for a zealous citizen. We pass on to our neighborhoods and our habitual provincial connections. There are inns and resting places. Such divisions of our country as have been formed by habit and not by sudden jerk of authority. These are so many little images of the great country in which the heart found something that it could fill. To love the whole is not to distinguish the subordinate parts. So it's only when we love the subordinate parts that we come to love the whole. Never from loving the whole do we love the subordinate parts. This is what Burke says. So all rights, all connections come literally from two people meeting each other. That's where it all starts. And from there, it goes outward. And that, you know, we could do this if I called on one of you to come up to the board and define your relations. Put a little stick figure of yourself. And then who would you immediately think of? I would assume your siblings, your mom, your dad, now probably because you're here, maybe someone in your dorm, your best friend, people you eat with, your sorority, your fraternity. Yeah, and we go from there. And my guess is that some of you probably even have much stronger loyalties to clubs you belong to on campus than to Hillsdale as a whole. Hillsdale gives those clubs sanction and gives them shelter. And that's what matters. So, you know, let's just pretend for a moment, I mean, somewhat silly, but let's just pretend for a moment that my iPhone 5, which I realize is now incredibly outdated, frankly, I hated it from the moment I had it. I just want a flip phone now. But let's say that I get a call, and it's President Trump. He's calling me. You know, Brad, I need your advice really quickly. This thing's gone wrong. I'd say, I'm sorry for President Trump. I've got 6 more minutes with my students. You'll have to wait. I would do that. But if my wife called, and she said, we just got a call from the academy, and Veronica fell and hurt herself, and we've got to go to the hospital, I'd tell you guys goodbye in an instant. So priorities, right? There's a choices. Yeah, I love you guys, and you've been a great class, but there are things that do take precedence over you. There are also things that don't. I don't consider my loyalty to Trump as president greater than my loyalty to you at all, not in the least. But to my wife and my kids, yeah, I do. And I would assume the same for you. If any one of you got a text message, Dad was in a car accident, God forbid, I wouldn't expect you to hang out in here. My gosh, go, right? That's what you've got to do. And this is what Burke is telling us. Just be logical about this. We start at the relationship. That's been that way since Adam and Eve. Right? That's what we do. Patrick, I'm sorry.
I was just saying, has Burke ever written directly against like Rousseau's totalitarianism?
Absolutely.
Rousseau is a direct influence in the French Revolution.
Oh, he is the anti-Rousseau, right? Burke is the anti-Rousseau. So let's finish with this, especially since you brought that up, Patrick. That's great. So let's turn to your Burke reading that you have here. And Patrick, if you don't mind, I'll just have you read.
Yeah, sure.
So just read that final paragraph, which is the one paragraph I want you all to know. that on 208, so this is page 208, and I'm going to have you read about half of it. So taking it for granted.
Taking it for granted that I do not write to the disciples of the Parisian philosophy, I may assume the awful author of our being is the author of our place in the order of existence, and that having disposed and marshaled us by a divine tactic, not according to our will, but according to his, he has, in and by that disposition, virtually subjected us to act the part which belongs to the place assigned us. We have obligations to mankind at large, which are not in consequence of any special voluntary pact. They arise from the relation of man to man, and the relation of man to God, which relations are not matters of choice. On the contrary, the force of all the pacts which we enter into with any particular person or number of persons among mankind depends upon these prior obligations. In some cases, the subordinate relations are voluntary, in others they are necessary, but the duties are all compulsive. When we marry, the choice is voluntary, but the duties are not a matter of choice. They are dictated by the nature of the situation. Dark and inscrutable are the ways by which we come into this world.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there, Patrick. All right, we've just got 2 minutes left, so I want you to think about this. And Patrick, thank you. It was beautifully read. I love this sentence. It's one of the most beautiful sentences in the English language. Dark and inscrutable are the ways by which we come into the world. There is not a single one of us in this room, not one, who chose the date of our birth, who chose our parents, who chose the situation, some of us probably good, some of us probably bad and abusive, whatever it may be, that was not of our making. But Burke tells us the moment we come of age, we do nothing but make choices. So for about 7 years, your life's not your own, and then suddenly everything is your own. So here he's perfectly mixing the oldest question of Western Civ. Are we free or are we predestined? And he says, guess what? We are totally predestined when it comes to our birth. And after that, we're as free as anyone who has ever been. And yet, what happens? I marry my wife, Deidre. We both completely chosen. We fell in love. We got married very quickly. We've been married now 21 years. It's been a great relationship. But the moment I married her, I surrendered my sovereignty. I surrendered it to her, and she surrendered it to me. I cannot just walk away now. We made a public oath to one another that no matter what, good and bad times, we would stick together. Nathaniel, sorry to embarrass you, buddy, but he was born literally 9 months to the day of our wedding night. That should all tell you something. He's turning very red. So, what does that mean? Well, we didn't set out to do that. It's just a happy accident, right? And it was great. But Nathaniel comes into the world. Man, my life changes dramatically. And I promise you guys, I'll end on this. I assume none of you have kids yet. But I guarantee you, there is nothing greater in the world. Nothing. Nothing comes close to seeing a child born. It is the coolest, most humbling moment ever in anyone's life. And it doesn't matter if it's child number one, or it's child number two, or for us, child number seven. They are all these unbelievable little mysteries. And you look at them when they come out, and of course they're gunky and bloody and gross. But you don't see that. I mean, you do, but you don't. Right? It's like, what you think is, holy Moses, God is trusting me with this little being? I'm not worthy at all. It is the most exhilarating and humbling experience you all will have. And that's what Burke is telling us. And here's what he says, and I love this. I'll finish with this. He says, you must recognize that every one of us is a product of the unbought grace of life. That's his phrase. We are the product of the unbought grace of life. Even if you've had a hard life, and I'm sure many of us have, I know crap happens, believe me. I know it. But you still have those moments of goodness. And Burke says, that's what you define your life by. Not the crud, not the sin, which we all go through, but those moments of grace that you did not ask for. That's what defines us. Okay, thanks everybody. Sorry, Anthony. I've been saying this stuff for 20 years. You just didn't mention the first one. Oh,
really anti-slavery. I mean, outside of like writing, you know, in Harlem,
so he's the crew.